Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In December 2024, I spoke to Dr. Douglas Fuller, Associate Professor in the Department of International Economics, Government and Business at Copenhagen Business School. Dr. Fuller studies the interaction of firms, politics, and technological change in East Asia. His research looks at the political economy of development, technology policy and strategy, and comparative capitalism. Ahead of his Phelan US Center US-China seminar, we spoke about how the Chinese high-tech and semiconductor chip industry has evolved, and the recent history and effectiveness of US chip controls towards China. We also talked about how the US has achieved a multilateral consensus for the implementation of chip controls, and whether these are likely to remain in place in the new administration of Donald Trump. I started out by asking Dr. Douglas Fuller to outline his research and current work.
I'm an associate professor at Copenhagen Business School. I've been doing research on China and Taiwan's technology policies for quite a long time now, including their semiconductor policies. Actually, so long that it was far from the hot topic that it is today. So much of my research has been about policy efficacy in high technology sectors in both of those economies.
So could you give our audience a brief background on the history of how the Chinese high-tech and semiconductor chip industry has evolved? Thank you.
So China's quite an interesting case because if you just look at the sheer amount of activity and production, China's been a tremendous success story over the course of the 21st century. It went from less than 1% of global production in semiconductors to, depending on how you're counting them, maybe 15% or more in recent years. But underneath that, there are a number of issues. In many other sectors, China has really closed the gap with the technological frontier. In the semiconductor industry, particularly on the fabrication, the core chip making aspect of the industry, they've struggled to do that. One of the brighter spots, though, has been on the design, the writing of the code that creates the chip design. There have been a number of Chinese firms who've become quite capable in that area. So the overall picture is a very large industry, but a bit more uneven in terms of the technological prowess.
So why is understanding this background important and relevant in understanding the modern semiconductor industry and the policies governing it undertaken by China today?
So I think a lot of what eventually came to pass outside of China in terms of industrial policies and export controls was in part driven by their own interpretation of their past industrial development. So in 2014, China launched this new, quite ambitious, so-called mega project in semiconductors. Before that time, China had quite an active industrial policy in semiconductors, but this new policy, just in terms of the amount of money that was projected to be spent by the central government and regional and local governments, it really dwarfed what had become before. And from a Chinese perspective, China needed this because they were running silicon deficit. Their deficit in semiconductors was larger than their deficit in oil. Of course, others might point out that China has become this very large export platform. So a lot of the computer chips they were importing were re-exports. So it wasn't really quite the deficit they projected. But also they were quite frustrated with what they felt were lack of success in catching up to the frontier, particularly in chip making in the semiconductor industry. However, from the point of view of outsiders, China had been this tremendous success. It had grown its production so much. So there was a lot of concern that what China had done in other sectors, such as solar panels, basically subsidizing their way to wiping out the rest of the global industry or most of it, would happen again in semiconductors. And from that point of view, you started to get more and more focus from foreign governments about, you know, the scale of Chinese ambitions, what countermeasures should be taken. Now, it took some time between 2014 until other countries really began to adopt these other measures. But I think from the point of view of many foreign governments, China had taken a too aggressive approach in yet another sector. And we see the consequences today with the various policies adopted in the US, Japan, the European Union, as well as the long-standing policies of Korea and Taiwan to support their industries.
So why has China historically struggled to develop a domestic semiconductor industry? And what changed to cause it to start making progress?
Prior to the 2000s, we have to keep in mind that China was quite a poor country compared to other countries in sort of the same level of economic development. It's not clear that they were somehow uniquely bereft of any capabilities in semiconductors. In the 1990s, they did try some industrial policies in this sector. They didn't tend to be very successful because they tend to use state-owned firms as national champions. And these firms tended to be relatively slow-moving and inflexible. And so they were not really the firms that went on to lead the industry. From 2000 onward, a number of different things happened. One, China was just becoming wealthier. There was more growth. There was more internal demand for chips within China. More and more returnees, either mainland Chinese returning from abroad, from places like the United States and the UK, or Taiwanese who'd been involved in the industry in Taiwan, started to come to China because they saw new opportunities there. The national and local government in general were very enthusiastic about supporting industrial investment, and the semiconductor industry from 2000 was no exception to this. So you started to see much more activities both in IC design and in building these chip making plants, these fabrication facilities, so-called fabs, from the year 2000 also. And that sort of fed on itself in this process that you were able to cultivate experienced workforce in these areas. There was this market out there for these goods within China. And there was a lot of this sort of virtual cycle going on. However, as I said, there still were some biases or attempts to support state-owned firms, even in this period. And so the problems with state-owned firms in fast-moving high-technology sectors kind of continued. Those firms tended to not be successful. So the Chinese state tried many different things. The more sort of formal targeted measures were going to support X, Y, and Z firms. Those did not work very well. But the measures where they were trying to sort of cultivate entrepreneurship in this sector, encourage investment, those were also open to other types of firms, foreign firms, firms with very complicated structures that were based in China but actually registered offshore so they could get external investment, and local private firms. And so you saw a growing industry, but they still were not quite able to catch up in fabrication. However, in defense of China, what has developed over the 21st century is there's a small number of firms who are able to do the most advanced chip making. You know, there's no European firm in this category. They're trying to create a new firm in Japan in this category. Even if you include not just logic chips that we mainly think of, NVIDIA chips or Apple chips, but also think of the memory chips, there's still, let's say, six firms maybe that are sort of at the cutting edge of chip making. Two are Korean, one Taiwanese, two American, and that may be generous because on the logic side, these mainstream chip side, it's really dominated by Taiwan's TSMC. So that's quite a high bar to say, well, China hasn't caught up to these firms. Because if you look around the world, other countries have sort of lagged further behind, like in Japan and Western Europe.
How do you understand the Chinese approach to developing a modern semiconductor industry? Is its main objective economic, or is it geopolitical, or both, or neither?
I would say that the objective is both. It's both for economic development. And of course, there's always a concern about national security. There's always the strong current of techno-nationalism running through Chinese discourse. And of course, if you're an ambitious policy entrepreneur in China, you sort of want to play this techno-nationalist card anyway to receive more resources. I would say, though, that the balance between techno-nationalism and economic development often depends on where you are within the system. If you're this local cadre in a regional government or local government, you're much more interested in fostering development. There are oftentimes sort of hard metrics measuring in a crude fashion economic development. So you're quite interested in hitting those targets and advancing your career. Now, those people also exist in Beijing, but a lot of the sort of measurement of economic success happens at these lower levels of government. So if you're in a central ministry, more often than not, you will have broader concerns. And obviously, the national security side then looms larger.
So you're giving a talk at the Phelan U.S. Center today as part of our U.S.-China seminar series. In this talk, you frame the development of American chip controls towards China as a question. So from unilateral failure to multilateral success, what is the history of American chip controls on China? And can you talk a bit about these policies, how they've been used, and their effectiveness? Thank you.
So these quite broad export controls on semiconductors are quite new. This started out in the Trump administration, where they did some policy innovation around this old system they already had, the entity list, where sort of bad actors were prevented from acquiring U.S. goods. Typically, these were not commercial firms, except maybe in the arms industry. But the Trump administration decided to target the telecommunications firm Huawei on national security grounds. So they put Huawei on the entity list. And then when they realized that the entity list, since it was made a number of decades ago, wasn't really fit for purpose, it could not effectively cut off Huawei from American technology that was produced outside the borders of the U.S., they invented new supplementary laws, such as the Foreign Direct Product Rule, which basically said Huawei couldn't even access American technology indirectly. So Huawei could no longer go to TSMC in Taiwan to manufacture Huawei's chips because TSMC was using American equipment. And so that was in violation of this Foreign Direct Product Rule. So at the end of the Trump administration, you had just started to see the implementation of these quite broad restrictions on Huawei. And several other firms also fell afoul of the new revived version of the entity list. Under the Biden administration, they took some time, almost 2 years, to come up with their own restrictions. But long before they did, it was obvious that they were quite concerned with China's ability to acquire or produce on their own very advanced chips for a number of different applications that they argue in the end all related back to national security. So you saw concerns about high performance computing, AI processing, which in and of themselves, you know, have many civilian uses, but obviously can also be dual use technologies. And they decided to target more advanced semiconductors in terms of the equipment and software to produce and design these advanced semiconductors as a way to another method to stop China from producing these dual use technologies.
So in case our audience isn't familiar with the US licensing regime for shipping semiconductors, can you please give a quick overview of what it is and how it works?
The licensing regime for these export controls is conducted through the Bureau of Industry and Security in the Department of Commerce of the US government. And the firms apply for a license to sell equipment to a specified vendor. Now, what happened in actuality often was a lot of exemptions were created. In theory, you had to receive licenses to, just based on the technology itself, to sell to Chinese vendors, but offshore production was given a pass-through that they did not effectively cut off. Another issue is that the system is quite opaque. It is not a system where, oh, today Applied Materials applied for a license for such and such to sell to such and such a firm, and it's automatically available to the public. Frankly, the firms like it this way. They don't really want their competitors, among others, to know what's going on in terms of their sales. And now with this quite broad regime, it's probably also helpful in providing, at least initially, some time lag before others see quarterly sales figures overall and other cruder metrics to indicate that the licensing regime isn't as strict as some people who are in favor of it would want it. On October 7th of 2022, the Biden administration came out with these new regulations targeting this advanced chip making equipment, targeting high performance computing, targeting AI processing. But these were quite unilateral, just like the initial entity list was. The Biden administration had tried already to get a fair amount of buy-in from allies, principally Japan and the Netherlands, because basically most of the advanced chip-making equipment comes from the United States, the Netherlands, or Japan. But they decided to essentially present a fait accompli. Here we have these new restrictions, and we welcome our allies to join us. Now, these restrictions were quite controversial. American firms were worried that they would not be able to sell their equipment, but of course, Japanese producers, the Dutch producer, ASML, would still be allowed to sell their equipment. However, the US government had also had a somewhat coercive element that if there were significant level of American technology embodied in foreign equipment, that equipment also would come under the US licensing regime. And that was very much the case with ASML's lithography equipment. So at the time, these seemed very dramatic, even perhaps draconian. But by the second quarter of 2023, looking at trade data, it was obvious that in implementation, something else had happened. There seemed to be a robust importation of equipment from the various American suppliers that you would think would be having to get licenses. And importantly, under the regulations, there was presumption of denial. Well, either they didn't need licenses or the licenses were easily available. At the same time that this was going on, the U.S. started to engage more with the Dutch and the Japanese to try to reach some accord between these three countries on the export controls. The Biden administration, not being the Trump administration, did not want to have such a confrontational approach with their allies. They, you know, emphatically wanted to have this contrast between themselves and the way Donald Trump did things. And through this process, they actually did have a fair amount of give and take. So with Japan, traditionally has very much been a notification, not a licensing type of export control regime. So firms just tell the government that they are going to sell various products to various countries and actors. But Japan initiated a new licensing regime for the semiconductor industry. But the U.S. also compromised. The original regulations were written that any equipment capable of such and such a process technology needed a license to be sold to actors in China. The Japanese designed four. So much narrower criteria. There's a lot of equipment that, you know, isn't designed for specific technical level, but can be used at that level. And the U.S. consequently rewrote its own regulations to conform to the Japanese controls. In the Dutch case, one interesting thing that was going on throughout this period was a lot of the initial technical regulations that the U.S. was using seemed to be quite ineffective, even nonsensical. According to some of the regulations, no such equipment existed because the technical metrics did not match any known equipment, particularly around lithography, this key equipment that ASML dominates as a near monopoly producer of. The metrics essentially would have allowed for quite advanced equipment to be sold to China. The Dutch actually rewrote them themselves to sort of tighten up those regulations. And then the U.S. borrowed from the Dutch regulations. So you saw a process arguably of both loosening and tightening through this interaction with allies. So a year after the initial regulations were announced, the U.S. had these revisions in October of 2023, incorporating the loosening on the Japanese side, trading designed for capability of, and then building upon the Dutch regulations to really tighten up on the lithography side to make it much harder for China to really do a fair amount of these advanced chips if they couldn't get this advanced technology. Right before all this happened, in August of 2023, there was so-called Huawei shock. It wasn't really that shocking to people paying attention that they were able to design this new phone that used advanced chips that were made by SMIC, a Chinese firm in Shanghai that itself was on the entity list for at least one of its fabs. Now, many people in China herald this as this sort of breakthrough, getting around the blockade set by the Americans. But when you actually look at it, SMIC was using a lot of American equipment. It's just that the regulations had been so porous up to this time. Not only the technical regulations, but also you could sell to third-party vendors. You didn't really know where their equipment was going to end up. You could sell to another SMIC fab, not the one that was on the entity list. But did the equipment stay in that fab? It was unclear. And so the U.S. tried to address a fair amount of these regulations, these issues in the October 2023 regulation. But throughout this whole process, it's not just adjusting to allies. It's also lobbying by firms. These American chip manufacturing equipment vendors did not want to be on extremely stringent export controls. So they were always trying to find ways to tweak the controls to create exemptions. And as far as they were concerned, reluctance by allied nations was a boon to them because then they could point out, look, the Japanese are doing it this way so they can sell to China, but we're not allowed to sell to China. Shouldn't we also have some exemptions? And we can see this process up to now that just why there was this new set of regulations again. Well, now a year and almost 2 months later, promising to tighten up, where we see even more equipment being sold to China in the interim from October 2023 to now.
So you've talked about how the American licensing regime is rife with loopholes. Is this the sort of thing you're talking about?
Exemption for these overseas sites is one of them. The other loopholes I mentioned were taking advantage of the fact that design for metric is relatively narrow, and then getting licenses for vendors who you should be suspicious of, but if it's in your interest to sell to them and they're not themselves on the entity list officially, you in the past have just gone ahead and sold to them. You see a lot of this addressed in the export controls, the revisions that came out yesterday on December 2nd, because in this 200-page document, there's a bunch of red flags they talk about where they're basically telling the firms, yes, you should have knowledge of the firms you're selling to, but you can't be willfully ignorant. There's a bunch of these red flags that you should pay attention to. If you're selling equipment to SMIC's other factory, which you know could possibly be used in that factory and could only be used in their most advanced fab, you should not be applying for a license because obviously that's in violation of the export controls. Or if you're selling to some third-party vendor and you have no idea where the equipment is actually going to end up, you better first vet this whole supply chain before applying for this license. So it was basically telling these sellers of equipment that they really had to do much more due diligence and not just rely on willful ignorance to keep applying for licenses. I mean, the most ridiculous example was selling to the non-advanced fab that SMIC has in Shanghai that's connected by a bridge to the advanced fab, saying, well, each fab has its own four walls. They're two separate entities. There's no problem. There should be no problem for me to sell equipment to the so-called non-advanced fab when there's every reason to expect that a lot of that equipment went over to the advanced fab.
What has allowed the U.S. to find a multilateral consensus for the implementation of these measures now and maybe not in the past? And do you think with the second Trump presidency approaching in January 2025, is this going to stay in place or may it change?
So we should emphasize that the U.S. also gave up quite a bit in trying to achieve a consensus. From the perspective of the people who are serious about the export controls, they don't really like the design for criterion, for example. And they gave other quite substantial exemptions to Japan and the Netherlands, even in this latest round. So the U.S. created new, what seemed quite broad, foreign direct product rules targeting new types of equipment. But then they exempted equipment that is from Japan and the Netherlands. They did not exempt Japanese companies who make equipment abroad or Dutch companies who make equipment abroad. So for all three of the producers, the US, Japan, and the Netherlands, there may be some impact on economic activities in this sector in Southeast Asia, where they have a lot of equipment production. But they're, as long as they make it within their home countries, they can then not be subject to these foreign direct product rules, which is quite a substantial exemption. I would anticipate going forward that the Trump administration might revisit this because it does seem like a very uneven playing field to have those exemptions for the major competitors and not have it for American firms. The other way to go about it, which some people are anticipating, is, well, you can write all these new rules. They're all very complicated. That allows for a lot of space for further loopholes. So at the end of the day, American sales to China semiconductor industry will not be that heavily impacted. It will just be business as usual. The future Trump administration is quite complicated. On the one hand, you could expect a very hard line on China. But on the other hand, Trump is always keen to be seen as pro-business. And even when his administration was managing the export controls against Huawei, there was a lot of licensing going on at that time. So this wasn't just about loose licensing under the Biden administration.
Well, that's the end of my substantive questions. I want to give you the opportunity to share any resources with our listeners, anything that you have, projects you're working on, books, articles, or anything you just like to point our listeners' attention towards. Thank you.
At some point next year, hopefully, though academic publishing moves with due deliberate speed, I will have a new book out from Cambridge University Press's Elements on the geopolitics of de-risking from China, looking at several industries, including semiconductors, and how the American, various European governments, Japan, and Korea have approached de-risking, and also how firms from those countries have approached de-risking to China. So hopefully at some point in 2025, that book will be out.
Brilliant. Well, that's something our listeners should look out for next year. Dr. Douglas Fuller, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you.
Dr. Douglas Fuller is Associate Professor of the Department of International Economics, Government, and Business at Copenhagen Business School. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Dr. Douglas Fuller for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rerangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.